pleased, I believe. At any rate, he is not with us this evening. He will be back next week, I trust. Those of you who are tuned in tonight, I want to apologize for being a little bit late, but again, some change I just found out earlier that Nip was not going to be here and necessitated a few changes in schedule and editing and so forth. So, anyway, we are here a little bit late, but we're here nonetheless. Those of you who are interested in a substantive way in the kind of material we talk about on this broadcast are strongly advised to tape the program this evening. Today we're going to put some more important information into our archives, that is to say, into a permanent tape file of the documentary sources upon which our arguments are based. Those are available from a tape duplication service, and this evening we're going to download some more information into the archives. We're going to talk tonight, among other things, about the Nazi euthanasia program, and we're going to talk about events today which bear an unnerving similarity to the chain of events and institutions which led up first to the Nazi euthanasia programs and then to the general Nazi extermination programs, which grew directly out of the euthanasia program. The tape from this evening is indeed going to be on permanent file with archives on audio, but those of you who are putting together your own independent tape library are strongly encouraged to be ready to tape this evening. Before we get down to that, let me go through a couple of announcements. First of all, unpleasant announcements. Those of you who have not already heard, be aware that this coming Thursday, and I believe the week after that, are going to be the last May Brussel tapes here on KFJC. May did a two-hour concluding broadcast this past Monday evening. Those 2 hours are going to occupy the last couple of hours on this coming Thursday at 9 p.m. and the following Thursday also at 9 p.m. May has been receiving a number of death threats, so have other people in this type of research, and May has arrived at a decision to proceed simply in the printed medium. She's going to send out private tape cassettes, but she's going to write articles and concentrate on that. It is a shame. May is the top researcher in this field, and up until her decision to go off the air, basically there were a grand total of 2 professional researchers working in radio on a regular basis. That is now halved to 1, that 1 at the moment being yours truly. There are other researchers who work on radio on occasion, but none who do so on a regular basis, which is unfortunate. Obviously, at this point, the universe has been halved from 2 down to a whopping 1. Also, I've continued to have a lot of interesting things happening to me. My apartment was entered at least 2 more times this past week, and again, whatever parties are entering, don't bother breaking in. They come right in through the front door. I don't know how many of you have, I'm sure there are a lot of you who are familiar with the avant-garde TV series The Prisoner, in which a British intelligence agent who attempts to retire is interned on an island, which is in fact a little village, like a little penal colony, and his house is bugged and monitored by television camera, and the authorities pay visits to him and put drugs in his food and all kinds of interesting things. And all I can say is for the past couple of weeks I've been living The Prisoner, and I'm going to continue to stay the course, but it is not exactly the most pleasant thing in the world. At any rate, that is what is going on at the present time. This coming Thursday at 9 p.m. and the following Thursday at 9 p.m., the last 2 May Brussel broadcasts here on KFJC. Now, upcoming programs of a different nature. Again, in just a few minutes, those of you who are putting together your own tape archives are going to be occupied, hopefully, taping what we're going to be doing this evening, which is some very, very important information about the Nazi euthanasia programs. Other programs coming up, however, other archive shows. This coming Tuesday, day after tomorrow, on sister station KKUP at 91.5 FM, we're going to be broadcasting Radio Free America show number 7, the third and concluding broadcast in a 3-part Radio Free America series dealing with mind control. That is to say, the U.S. National Security Establishment's successful efforts at developing both individual and group mind control. This coming Tuesday, at 8 p.m. on KKUP 91.5 FM, we're going to be talking about cults as fronts for intelligence activity. That's KKUP 91.5 FM, mono only, this coming Tuesday, day after tomorrow. That's March 15th, 8 p.m. to midnight. March 15th, Tuesday, day after tomorrow, KKUP 91.5 FM, mono only, so don't have your stereo light on. Be tuned in, be ready to tape for Radio Free America number 7. Then, 2 weeks after that, on Tuesday, March 29th, Be tuned in right here on KFJC at 89.7 FM from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. for Radio Free America number 2, a very important show, that one called Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 2. That's Tuesday, March 29th, 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. right here on KKUP. We're going to take a very short musical break, this mainly by way of punctuation. Then we're going to proceed into the first part of tonight's prepared portion. We should have time for phone calls, but again, it's a long prepared portion intended for the archives, and it will be on permanent file with Archives on Audio. Oh, before I break very shortly, let me explain. Archives on Audio is a tape duplication service. All of our archive shows, all of our documentary broadcasts consisting of the evidence upon which our arguments are based are on permanent file with Archives on Audio. They're based up in San Francisco. The address is Archives on Audio, P.O. Box 170023, Box 170023. That is in San Francisco, the zip code 94117-0023. 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. 415-346-1840. Neither NIP nor myself nor this station makes any money off of this operation. And One Step Beyond shows are also available for a period of roughly a month, sometimes a little more, from Archives on Audio. That is to say, for a period of a month after each One Step Beyond broadcast. They are not, with some exceptions, on permanent file, however. Only our archive shows, Guns of November, Radio Free America, and the miscellaneous shows are on permanent file. But I will give you the address for Archives on Audio. Late in the broadcast, we're going to take a very short musical break now, by way of punctuating the broadcast. Then we're going to swing into the first part of tonight's program, the Nazi euthanasia programs and their relevance for today's world in terms of what's going on. Be tuned in, be ready to tape in just a couple of minutes. Well, good evening once again. Welcome back to One Step Beyond. Welcome back to the prepared portion for tonight's broadcast from March 13th of 1988. Those of you who eventually hear this program by tape will hear the program as part of our permanent archives. This particular program is called the Nazi Euthanasia Programs and the Mental Hygiene Movement. This evening we're going to talk about euthanasia. We're going to talk about the Nazi Euthanasia Programs in the Third Reich. We're going to talk about their relevance for the eventual Nazi extermination programs of what they refer to as contragenics, people like Jews, Gypsies, homosexuals, and so forth. We're going to be looking against this We're going to be looking at this, I should say, against the background of a number of things that are going on today. There is currently a move afoot in the United States to liberalize the official attitude towards euthanasia, that is, towards mercy killing. We're going to take a look at events in contemporary America and events in Weimar Germany and Nazi Germany, and hopefully draw some important lessons from this comparison, which will help us to avoid a situation like that which took place in the Third Reich. I'm going to ask listeners to bear with me this evening. I am by myself this evening. The research angle I can certainly handle with no problem whatsoever. However, this is going to be a fairly long program, and in as much as my usual co-host Nip Tuck is not here to share with the reading duties, there will be a little more on my shoulders than is usually the case. The book that we're going to be relying on very heavily this evening is a long one. The print is very small, and it's a translation from German, and it's not the easiest thing to read. The translation is not perhaps the best that might have been. It's certainly very cogent, but parts of it are sort of awkward when reading aloud. So bear with me if I falter in occasional spots here, as I'm going to be reading probably for a good 2 hours or so. This a very important program, though, so I felt even though Nip is not here, I would go ahead and handle the information, and even though the on-air presentation will suffer somewhat due to Nip's absence, the research part is 100% under control, so I think for the benefit of our listeners, we're going to go ahead and present this information as is. Again, bear with me if I falter once or twice in the writing, or in the reading, rather, but reading for 2 hours or so is not the easiest thing in the world. It's not something, certainly, that I can do perfectly. Let me give you a rundown of what tonight's broadcast is going to consist of. The information we're going to be looking at almost exclusively comes from a book called The Men Behind Hitler, authored by Bernhard Schreiber, or Schreiber, S-C-H-R-E-I-B-E-R, a German writer. We're going to begin the broadcast by taking a look at the intersection of three important elements of tonight's broadcast. We're going to be taking a look at the intersection between the international eugenics movement and the international mental hygiene movement, and in turn, those two intersecting institutions' advocacy of euthanasia as a tool for bringing about their respective ends. Eugenics, of course, is the practice or science of selectively breeding individual human beings in order to produce a master race, in order to promote those hereditary characteristics considered desirable by the society instituting the eugenics program. The mental hygiene movement intersects very heavily with the eugenics program and draws heavily, or drew and continues to draw very heavily on the ranks of the eugenics movement. The mental hygiene movement is just what its name would imply. It basically is a movement to promote, quote, healthy mental types. Implicit in this is the elimination of, quote, unhealthy mental types, meaning people who are mentally afflicted, people who are retarded and suffering from some sort of physical disability, as well as frequently people considered criminal as well. The two main devices that have been traditionally advocated by promoters of the eugenics and international mental hygiene movements have been both sterilization and euthanasia, or mercy killing, to eliminate the undesirable characteristics. We're going to begin by taking a look at the international eugenics movement, and we're going to take a look in particular at its intersection with a number of key German intellectuals. We're going to take a look at how the international eugenics movement in turn intersects with the international mental hygiene movement, how they advocated euthanasia, and we're going to take a look at how many of the key people involved in implementing the Nazi euthanasia programs grew out of an intellectual and cultural milieu associated with the international eugenics and international mental hygiene movement. And in turn, as I said, those institutions and organizations advocated euthanasia as a means for bringing about the desired end. We're going to take a look at how the Nazi euthanasia program grew out of these mainstream international intellectual organizations, namely, again, international eugenics, international mental hygiene movements, closely intersecting and interrelated, and their advocacy of euthanasia. Then we're going to take a break. Then we're going to come back and we're going to take a look at specifically how the Nazi euthanasia program in the Third Reich grew out of a number of institutions and individuals associated with the German mental hygiene movement. Essentially, the Nazi euthanasia program sprang out of Nazi medical practice and specifically Nazi psychiatric theory and practice. We're going to take a look at a number of key people. The key names that we're going to be looking at are the advocacy of German social, the chief advocate of German social Darwinism, a Dr. Alfred Ploetz, P-L-O-E-T-Z, or Ploetz, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, so I'm going to pronounce it Ploetz, P-L-O-E-T-Z. An associate of his, Dr. Ernst Rudin, R-U-D-I-N, very important people. Ernst Rudin, later closely associated with Wilhelm Frick, the Third Reich Minister of the Interior, and the person who signed into law the law for the protection of the German blood, under which the Nazi extermination programs were carried out. Some other key names involved with the German mental hygiene movement, Drs. Bauer and Lenz, and we're going to take a look at Drs. Bauer, Lenz, Ploetz, and Rudin, and how they intersected with a Dr. Verschuer, and in turn, one of Dr. Verschuer's pupils went on to become a key individual in the Third Reich extermination programs. That fellow was Dr. Josef Mengele, the supposedly late Nazi war criminal. We're going to take a look at a key case which was used to legally and philosophically open the door to the Nazi mass killing programs in the minds of the average citizen. This was an appeal to Hitler by the parents of a gravely deformed infant. This child was born apparently retarded and severely handicapped physically, and this little girl's parents appealed to Hitler for permission to have the little girl put to sleep. And this permission was eventually granted, and that order on the part of the Führer was used as the moral, legal, and philosophical justification for subsequent Nazi extermination programs. This is not in some ways unlike the significance of the Fritz Haarmann case in the deep sixing of the nascent gay rights movement in Weimar Germany, and the manipulation of the issue of gay rights by the Nazis to their own advantage as they rose to power. We took a look at that in an archive show currently available on permanent file from Archives on Audio called gay rights, called the Pink Triangle, gay rights, reproductive rights, and the Third Reich. We're going to take a look again at this key case in which this deformed little girl was granted the permission to die by the Führer and its legal, moral, and political significance in the Third Reich. We're going to take a look, too, at the governing consideration in determining who was put to death under the Third Reich euthanasia programs. Basically, people who were considered to be more socially useful had a better chance of surviving. Then we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to take a look at the formal implementation of the T4 program. T4 stands for Tiergartenstrasse 4, which is where the Führer Chancellery was located in Berlin. This was the most secret of all of the Nazi programs, namely the Nazi extermination programs. In addition to the so-called final solution to the Jewish problem, the Nazi extermination of the Jews, the euthanasia programs under which the retarded, the mentally ill, the old, the infirm were gotten rid of was also done out of the T4 office. We're going to take a look at how the euthanasia program was implemented as an extension of Nazi psychiatric practice. We're going to take a look at the 6 main killing centers at which mentally ill, retarded, and so forth were put to death. And we're going to take a look in particular at how the overall Nazi extermination programs grew out of the euthanasia programs. Not only did the euthanasia program open the door legally and philosophically to the killing of other people who did not suffer from the sorts of obvious disabilities that the victims of the euthanasia programs did, but beyond that, the 6 murder institutions that were used to kill the people under the euthanasia program were used as training grounds in order to harden the people who were later to staff the larger and better known death factories such as Auschwitz, Dachau, and so forth. This is a very important consideration. Not only did the death centers, the killing centers for the euthanasia program, there were 6 of them, serve as training grounds for the people who were later to staff the larger death camps, but in addition, the 6 killing centers under the euthanasia program served as laboratories where the killing techniques could be scientifically perfected. So, again, the euthanasia program is a very, very important element in the development of the Nazi extermination programs, philosophically and in terms of technical know-how. We're going to take a look then at how the German eugenics and mental hygiene movements were incorporated readily back into the world eugenics and the international eugenics and mental hygiene movements at the conclusion of World War II. Again, perhaps the single most important lesson to derive from the broadcast this evening is that the Third Reich extermination programs were not an accident. As with so many other aspects of the Third Reich that we've focused on over the years that we've had these programs and that Mae Brussel has talked about for years before us, is that the Third Reich was not an aberration. This wasn't something that was done by a weird little man with a mustache a long time ago. The Nazi extermination program, stemming from the euthanasia program, grew out of a very broad and very broad-based and very important international intellectual movement, the eugenics slash mental hygiene movement. And this movement is in no way separate from certain mainstream intellectual, political, and economic trends that are in effect today. And again, much as we've taken a look at how many key American industrial and financial institutions lent support to Hitler, and we've taken a look at the intersection between Nazi industry and finance and the international cartel system, that on Uncle Sam and the Swastika, primarily the first 2 Radio Free America shows, the second of which will be coming up later this month on KFJC, also Radio Free America number 10, the first of our Aryan Nation series, we took a look at the economic interests that brought Hitler to power as well. Then later, as we looked at, as we have looked at repeatedly on these programs, the residua of the Third Reich National Security Establishment were incorporated into the United States at the end of World War II. Again, what happened in Nazi Germany under the Third Reich was not an aberration, and it was in no way separated off from what is happening today. So many people, when they look at Nazi Germany and the Third Reich, think of it as something a long time ago and having no lessons for us today. Regrettably, that's not the case. By way of concluding the broadcast this evening, we're going to take a look at some reflections on how the Nazi programs were instituted in Germany. This drawing on some material that comes from another one of our archive shows called They Thought They Were Free, which gives a number of subjective reports on what the subjective experience was like growing up in Weimar and Nazi Germany and what it was like from an experiential sense to see the gradual implementation of the Nazi program. Again, I think the reflections here will have some relevance for us today. We're going to begin by taking a look at two editorials from the New York Times over the last couple of years, both dealing with euthanasia. This first editorial begins, we read this last week on One Step Beyond, and we're going to begin with it again this evening. This comes from the New York Times of Friday, February 26th of 1988. It's by Mark Siegler, and it's Dateline Chicago. It's headlined, The AMA Euthanasia Fiasco. Strange and unsettling things are happening in American medicine. On January 8th, the Journal of the American Medical Association published an anonymous article by a young, tired, unsupervised physician in training who admitted that he deliberately killed another doctor's patient by administering a fatal dose of morphine sulfate after the patient told him, quote, let's get this over with, unquote. Even stranger, this voluntary confession is published without editorial comment from the American Medical Association, an organization occasionally accused of being a tad staid and conservative. Not this time. Dr. George Lundberg, editor of the journal, says he was just doing his job in publishing the article, It's Over, Debbie. Dr. Lundberg says he hoped to stimulate a debate among physicians about the issue of mercy killing, unquote. This isn't conservative, it's radical. It's like the Defense Department sponsoring an essay contest for military personnel on the topic, treason, for or against. The journal acted irresponsibly in publishing this essay without attribution, without verification of the facts, and without a hint of legal or moral disapproval, thereby giving the appearance of tacit approval. Killing of patients by physicians is not a proper topic for value-free discussion. The prohibition against killing is a fundamental rule in medicine as elsewhere, and it's a rule we've tampered with only at enormous peril for patients, physicians, and society. The question of medical killing is with us and must be discussed responsibly. Opinion polls show that many people support legalization of physician-assisted suicide, which is advocated by organizations like the Hemlock Society. A voter initiative in California would achieve its goal. Clearly, a problem exists. The public has deep fears about the process of dying in hospitals, about becoming dependent, and about whether doctors will provide adequate relief of pain and suffering even for terminally ill patients. Medical killing is regarded by some as a quick fix to the dual problems of dying and dependence, and further, as a way to control the power of physicians. But this quick fix will fix nothing and will cost plenty. If killing by physicians is legalized, everyone will lose. All patients will be endangered by such a policy, but particularly those who are old, physically disabled, mentally impaired, poor, and uninsured. Skipping down in the article. Moving from acknowledgement of a person's claim to a right to die, unquote, to a society that enforces a duty to die, unquote, might prove all too easy with our aging society caught in an environment of cost containment. I would also add that with the recent emphasis on the tremendous burden, economic burden, that AIDS is placing on the medical system, that statement about cost containment bears perhaps even more relevance than it might have under other circumstances. And again, on these broadcasts, we've looked long and hard at the probability that AIDS is in fact a biological warfare experiment, specifically the application of genetic engineering to the art of war. That is to say, by our own national security establishment. Another column, this one actually from the San Jose Mercury News, rather, not the New York Times, although it's a New York writer, will give us some background on perhaps why the Journal of the American Medical Association should have taken such a casual approach to an article like the one that advocated implicitly euthanasia. This again from the San Jose Mercury News, specifically from the San Jose Mercury of Thursday, April 3rd of 1986. This is an article by Nat Hentoff, who covers civil liberties for the Village Voice, also now incidentally a fellow who advocates mandatory AIDS testing. So his comments here are interesting in the light of his later stance on mandatory testing for AIDS. This particular column is called Sliding Toward Euthanasia, and again, it's by Nat Hentoff. 11 years ago, the parents of Karen Ann Quinlan persuaded a judge to order their comatose daughter removed from a respirator. But Joseph Quinlan was astonished when asked if he also wanted her intravenous feeding ended. Oh no, he said, that is her nourishment, unquote. Since then, a growing number of families have tried, with varying results, to have the feeding tubes of wives, husbands, and other relatives taken away on the ground that they are in a vegetative state, unquote, and should be allowed to die with dignity, unquote. This prescription for euthanasia, although the controversial word itself is avoided, now has the official support of the American Medical Association. Its 7-member judicial council has unanimously ruled that it is ethical for doctors to withhold, quote, all means of life-prolonging medical treatment, unquote, including food and water, if a patient is in a coma, quote, that is beyond doubt irreversible, and there are adequate safeguards to confirm the accuracy of the diagnosis, unquote. Death, it is carefully noted, need not be imminent for food and water to be stopped. Dr. Nancy Dickey, D-I-C-K-E-Y, chairman of the council, told Lawrence K. Altman of the New York Times that, quote, there is no medical definition of adequate safeguards, no checklist, unquote, that doctors would have to fill out in each case. The decision would be up to each doctor. In an editorial, the Times has called the AMA's adoption of the euthanasia principle a welcome contribution, unquote. Medical ethics and human rights aside, giving physicians such ultimate power is rather disquieting because not all doctors may be competent to make such final decisions on their own. Dr. Arnold Relman, editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, estimated that out of a physician population of 400,000, there may well be, quote, 20 or maybe even 30,000 bad or impaired doctors, unquote. And that, he adds, could be a conservative estimate. It is hardly unknown, says Michigan University law professor Yale Kamisar, K-A-M-I-S-A-R, for doctors to make all kinds of mistakes in their diagnoses. In some cases, there might be a 10% or a 5% chance that the patient would come out of the coma, unquote. As for the long-range effects of the AMA's ruling, Dr. Norman Levinsky, chief of medicine at Boston University Medical Center and a prominent medical ethicist, told me, quote, this gives doctors and other caregivers a message that it's okay to kill the dying and get it over with. It ought to be difficult for doctors to stop doing things for their patients, but this makes it a little easier. Also, it is not a huge step from stopping the feeding to giving a patient a little more morphine to speed his end. I mean, it is not a big step from passive to active euthanasia, unquote. Levinsky is also concerned about the effect of the AMA position on what he calls the making of medical decisions according to class. I have no question, he says, that some physicians and other caregivers consider the life of someone over 80 to be less worthy than that of someone who is 28. This approval by the AMA of withholding food and water could accelerate that kind of medical care. I'm going to repeat this past sentence, this past statement here, because we're going to come back to an unnerving similarity to this later on in the broadcast. Levinsky is also concerned about the effect of the AMA position on what he calls the making of medical decisions according to class. I have no question, he says, that some physicians and other caregivers consider the life of someone over 80 to be less worthy than that of someone who is 28. This approval by AMA of withholding food and water could accelerate that kind of medical care, unquote. As originally reported in the New York Times, the AMA announcement appeared to have been made in conjunction with the Hastings Center, which specializes in thorny bioethical problems. The center, whose members are of different minds on the subject, denies this and points to a 1983 article by its director, Daniel Callahan, in which he wrote, quote, the feeding of the hungry, whether because they are poor or because they are physically unable to feed themselves, is the most fundamental of all human relationships. It is a most dangerous business to tamper with or adulterate, so enduring and central a moral emotion, unquote. And Kamisar, who for years has been tracking the growing acceptance of euthanasia, which has appeared under such disguises as the right to die, unquote, points out that the courts will give the AMA pronouncement great weight, unquote. But, he emphasizes, this fundamental moral, legal, and philosophical issue is not for only doctors to decide, unquote. Yet many physicians seem to believe it essential that only they determine the ethics of bringing life to an end. This disturbed one of them, the late Dr. Leo Alexander, who is with the Office of the Chief Counsel for War Crimes at Nuremberg. Last year, philosophy professor Patrick Durer wrote in the Boston Globe that Dr. Alexander had been much distressed at a New England Journal of Medicine article by a group of doctors advocating the starvation of certain kinds of patients. Quote, it is much like Germany in the 20s and 30s, Dr. Alexander said. The barriers against killing are coming down. Unquote. That last sentence again. It is much like Germany in the 20s and 30s, Dr. Alexander said. The barriers against killing are coming down, unquote. That from Dr. Leo Alexander, who is with the Office of the Chief Counsel of War Crimes at Nuremberg. Now, we're going to proceed from an examination of the contemporary attitudes towards euthanasia to some information concerning the growth of the euthanasia programs in Nazi Germany, and we're going to study the relationship between the euthanasia programs in Nazi Germany and the eventual growth of the Nazi extermination programs, culminating, in the liquidation of the European Jews. Most of the rest of the broadcast this evening is going to come from a book called The Men Behind Hitler. The Men Behind Hitler is authored by Bernhard Schreiber, B-E-R-N-H-A-R-D-S-C-H-R-E-I-B-E-R, and the editor is John Schoenberg. And this book was published in the English language edition by Section 5 Books in San Francisco, February 1983. The copyright is by author Bernhard Schreiber. And there is also the acknowledgement here to William Hodge and Company Limited of Glasgow, Scotland, for permission to reproduce photographs from their 1949 publication, The Trial of Alphonse Klein, Adolf Valmont et al., The Hadamar Trial. Okay, so again, The Men Behind Hitler, Bernhard Schreiber, edited by John Schoenberg, Section 5 Books, San Francisco, California, copyright by the author, February 1983. And in the first section of the broadcast this evening, we're going to be taking a look at the intersection of three things, all of them central to an understanding of the growth of the Nazi euthanasia program. And again, the most important lesson perhaps to derive from the broadcast this evening is that the Nazi euthanasia programs, like the Third Reich itself, were in no way isolated phenomena. They were the inevitable outgrowths of certain political, historical, and economic trends in the Western world. And this evening we're going to take a look at two of these political and cultural trends and the eventual effect they had on the Nazi euthanasia and extermination programs. We're going to look at the growth of the international eugenics movement, the growth of the international mental hygiene movement, inextricable with, although not coterminous with, the international eugenics movement. In turn, we're going to look at the international eugenics movement and the international mental hygiene movement's advocacy of euthanasia as a tactic to achieve their goals. Again, from The Men Behind Hitler by Bernhard Schreiber. The first section that we're going to read is called Survival of the Fittest, and it talks about the growth of eugenics. Now, the key names here are Dr. Alfred Pletz, P-L-O-E-T-Z, and Dr. Ernst Rudin, R-U-U-M-L-A-U-T-D-I-N. Both of them are key members of the German Eugenics Society. Both of them had a key influence on the intellectual and cultural milieu which gave rise to the Nazi euthanasia programs. Dr. Ernst Rudin in particular is inextricably linked with a number of the officials who eventually put into effect the Nazi extermination programs. Reading from The Men Behind Hitler by Bernhard Schreiber. In 1900, the founder of racial hygiene in Germany, Dr. Alfred Pletz, P-L-O-E-T-Z, participated in an essay contest. It was sponsored by the industrialist Alfred Krupp, who gave a prize for the best essay on the subject, quote, "What can we learn from the principles of Darwinism for application to inner political development and the laws of the state?" unquote. Many people entered, and most essays agreed that a biological blueprint and a group of biologically fit must maintain a pure strain to ensure the further existence of the state. Wilhelm Schallmeyer, S-C-H-A-L-L-M-E-Y-E-R, won first prize, interpreted culture, society, morality, and even right and wrong in terms of the struggle for survival. Wilhelm Schallmeyer, who won first prize, interpreted culture, society, morality, and even right and wrong in terms of the struggle for survival. He wanted all laws brought into line with these concepts to prevent the white races from degenerating to the level of the Australian Aborigines. Such a degradation would be unavoidable if society continued to pander to the physical or mentally weak. His colleague, Dr. Alfred Pletz, endorsed the whole essay and supported the superiority of the Caucasian race, from which, of course, he accepted the Jews. For instance, he suggested that in times of war, in order to preserve the race, only racially inferior persons should be sent to the front. As the soldiers in the front line are usually the ones who were killed, this would preserve the purer part of the race from being unnecessarily weakened. He further suggested that a panel of doctors be present at the birth of each child to judge whether the child was fit enough to live, and if not, kill it. I'll interrupt that particular advocacy there by Dr. Alfred Pletz, and we're going to come to see the influence he wielded in Germany during the first half of this century. calls to mind the criticism on the part of a number of peace organizations of American conscription practices, in particular during the Vietnam War, in which a disproportionate number of economically disadvantaged people comprised frontline troops in the Vietnam War, and they also suffered disproportionate casualties, that is to say, primarily blacks and Latino Americans. Continuing now with the men behind Hitler. In 1901, Galton, that's Francis Galton, an advocacy of social Darwinism and, in fact, a half-brother, I believe it was, of Darwin himself. In 1901, Francis Galton delivered a lecture to the English Royal Anthropological Society, stressing the various possibilities of improving human breeding under the present social, legal, and moral conditions. In 1904, the first chair in eugenics and working society in eugenics were instituted at University College London, and these led to the establishment of the Galton Laboratory of National Eugenics in 1907. Soon, eugenics groups began to spring up all around the world. In 1908, the Eugenics Education Society, renamed the Eugenics Society in the 1920s, was founded in England, and in 1910, the Eugenic Record Office in the United States. Both institutes used the research results of the Galton Laboratory of National Eugenics to propose practical applications, and they made it their task to intensively propagandize the eugenic idea to the public. Dr. Alfred Pletz, the same man who had assisted Schollmeyer with his prize essay, in 1905 founded the Gesellschaft für Rassenhygiene, the Society for Racial Hygiene, in Germany. Later it changed its name to Gesellschaft für Rassenhygiene Eugenik, which means the Society for Racial Hygiene or Eugenics. This racial hygiene and eugenics were in fact, this change of name took place after Galton's announcement that racial hygiene and eugenics were in fact synonymous terms. These terms used in the German language were not only interchangeable, but racial hygiene was taken to be the German translation of eugenics. As racial hygiene was closely connected with political anthropology, a pseudoscience developed by de Gobineau, that's Count de Gobineau, an early pan-German theoretician, eugenics was used, let me read that sentence again, that's who Gobineau is here, an early pan-German theoretician born in France. As racial hygiene was closely connected with political anthropology, a pseudoscience developed by de Gobineau, eugenics was used in the scientific basis upon which racialist and political ideas, especially those of the Nazis, were based. And again, the eugenics concept, the Nazi racial theories, grew directly out of a mainstream international intellectual and cultural milieu, namely the international eugenics movement. That last sentence again. As racial hygiene was closely connected with political anthropology, a pseudoscience developed by Count de Gobineau, eugenics was used as the scientific, unquote, basis upon which racialist and political ideas, especially those of the Nazis, were based. In 1904, Dr. Alfred Pletz founded the journal Archiv für Rassen- und Gesellschaftsbiologie, the Archive for Racial and Social Biology, which after 1 year of existence became the official organ of the Gesellschaft für Rassenhygiene, the Society for Racial Hygiene, which Pletz had created. A co-founder of this society was the later world-famous psychiatrist and racial hygienist, Professor Dr. Ernst Rudin, R-U-U-M-L-A-U-T-D-I-N. So the key names here, Dr. Alfred Pletz and Dr. Ernst Rudin, both of them key intellectuals in the milieu, which was to the German eugenics milieu, which was to give rise to Nazi racial theory. And again, the Herr Doctors Pletz and Rudin were part of a mainstream international intellectual and political movement, the international eugenics movement. And that in turn is going to intersect very closely with the international mental hygiene movement. The point being, as we're going to see how the Nazi extermination programs grew out of these movements and their advocacy of euthanasia, is that the Nazi extermination programs, again, were not some political and historical aberration. Continuing now with Bernhard Schreiber's discussion of the mental hygiene movement and how it intersects with the international eugenics movement. The mental hygiene movement drew strongly from the eugenic movements of whatever country they were in, and in fact, the mental hygiene movements were permeated with eugenic thought. In 1931, the publishing firm Walter de Gruyter & Company published the Handwörterbuch der Physischen Hygiene und der Psychiatrischen Fürsorge, the Handbook of Mental Hygiene and Psychiatric Care, as an official psychiatric reference work containing a high proportion of eugenically oriented contributors. Frequent references are made throughout the book to eugenics, planned marriages, heredity, degeneration, etc., and under the heading mental hygiene, unquote, we find the following. Therefore, the hereditary constitution of a personality is the first and most effective point of prophylactic intervention. In the sense of eugenic psychiatry, it is necessary to hinder unfavorable hereditary combinations and bring about favorable ones, and especially to prevent the propagation of the hereditary traits of physical illness and the socially inferior psychopathies. Unquote. The principle that prevention of birth of the mentally ill would eradicate mental illness became an operating principle for every mental hygiene group in the world. That last sentence again. The principle that prevention of birth of the mentally ill would eradicate mental illness became an operating principle for every mental hygiene group in the world. In Germany, as in other countries, the theoreticians and practitioners of mental hygiene recruited mainly from eugenically oriented groups. Among them was the psychiatrist Emil Kreplin, K-R-A-E-P-E-L-I-N, a close friend of Dr. Alfred Pletz and Dr. Ernst Rudin, professor of psychiatry at Munich University, co-editor with Pletz of the Archiv für Rassen- und Gesellschaftsbiologie, and co-founder of the Gesellschaft für Rassenhygiene Eugenik, Society for Racial Hygiene and Eugenics. In 1933, the Nazi Reichsminister of the Interior, Wilhelm Frick, nominated Rudin as his honorary representative on the board of directors of two German racial hygiene unions. It is even more significant that Rudin was appointed by Frick to work together with the ministry in the reconstruction of the German race. So here we see Ernst Rudin, one of the prime intellectual advocates of eugenics and mental hygiene, intersecting directly with the Third Reich. And now we're going to see how the Third Reich's euthanasia programs grew out of this particular program. Continuing now with the description of how the intellectual milieu underlying the international eugenics and mental hygiene movements intersected with the Third Reich and gave rise to the Nazi euthanasia programs. On the occasion of Rudin's 65th birthday, Pletz honored his achievements in the Archiv für Rassen- und Gesellschaftsbiologie. Quote, "So just recently, he received the Goethe Medal for Art and Science from the Führer in recognition of his achievements in the development of German racial hygiene. The Reichsminister of the Interior, Dr. Frick, sent him the following telegram. To the indefatigable champion of racial hygiene and meritorious pioneer of the racial hygienic measures of the Third Reich, I send my sincerest congratulations on his 65th birthday. May you be granted many more years to continue your research for the welfare of mankind. The Congress of German Psychiatrists, Neurologists, and Internists at Wiesbaden awarded him the Heredity Medal." Unquote. So, again, we've taken a look at the international eugenics movement, how it intersects with the international mental hygiene movement, and in turn, how that began to intersect with the Third Reich and its formulation of its euthanasia programs. We're going to now take a look specifically at the development and advocacy of euthanasia as a tool for achieving the goals of the international eugenics and mental hygiene movement, i.e. a physically and mentally pure, unquote, race. Continuing with The Men Behind Hitler by Bernhard Schreiber. While the whole world was being prepared by propaganda for the sterilization of the insane, the adherents of mental hygiene and eugenics were preparing their next step. Euthanasia, by definition, means an easy death. It is usually understood that it should be in a painless, peaceful fashion for someone who is incurable and dying. It is also known as mercy killing, unquote. In 1895, Dr. Alfred Pletz had, as we have seen, introduced social Darwinism into Germany and founded racial hygiene. In his book, Fundamental Outline of Racial Hygiene, he calls for the elimination of counter-selective processes, i.e., those processes which eliminate the strong and favor the weak. Among these, he includes war and the protection of the weak and the ill. As an illustration, he gives the example of a newly married couple who give birth to a weak or malformed child who would be given an easy death with a small dose of morphine by a board of doctors. In 1922, Carl Binding, B-I-N-D-I-N-G, a jurist, and Alfred Hoch, H-O-C-H-E, a psychiatrist, wrote, quote, "The release of the destruction of life devoid of value," unquote. Die Freigabe der Vernichtung lebenswerten Lebens. They argued in favor of euthanasia that the unfortunate are a burden to themselves and society, and their parting would cause no great loss. The cost of keeping these useless people was excessive, and that the state could better spend the money on more productive issues. They felt that the physically and mentally defective should be painlessly eliminated and demanded the nullification of the religious and legal barriers which stood in the way. Hocke was an influential, authoritative psychiatrist, and argued that the moral attitudes toward the preservation of life would soon drop away, and the destruction of useless lives would become a necessity for the survival of society.